welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 42, The Battle of Brooklyn, part 1. So I'm sorry for the late Friday posting, but unfortunately there was a close family friend who passed away, so I spent some time consoling my family. But I'm putting the episode out tonight, Friday night, and I will also be putting out an episode beginning of next week. I did have to break the Battle of Brooklyn into two separate parts because, well, there's just so much information going on. And I probably mistitled the last episode, calling it The Invasion Begins, because we're about to start the invasion right now. The invasion officially begins on August 22nd at 9 a.m. A signal gun is fired from the HMS Eagle, Admiral Howe's flagship. This puts into motion 75 longboats. Their target was a beach on Gravesend Bay at the southern tip of Brooklyn. This is around about the current home of Coney Island today. The advance party which was landing was of Clinton and Cornwallis's 4,000 troops. When their men land, the second wave will begin. Protecting the landing were the frigates Phoenix, Rose, and Greyhound, along with two mortar vessels, the Carcass and the Thunder. Yes, that same Thunder from back in the Sullivan Island episode. At the Narrows, which is where today we see the Verrazano Bridge, the HMS Rainbow had aimed her guns at the Dencie's Ferry. Back in July, General Greene had used artillery from there to harass the fleet. So just in case he tried that again, the Rainbow was posted up there prepared to answer any artillery fired from land. Along with all this muscle, the British also deployed 11 bateaux and two row galleys. They were built on Staten Island over the summer. These ships were armed with a cannon at the front, with some swivel guns. Their shallow draft allowed them to get over the shoals and stay close to the landing craft and protect them from land fire. Howe spent the summer building boats and specialty landing craft that had hinge doors that would drop as soon as they hit land, which would make troops unloading and supplies unloading much quicker. The work actually paid off because the landings were started at 9 a.m. and finished by noon. The Continentals could really do nothing to stop it. Colonel Hand's 300 Pennsylvania riflemen were deployed almost as a scout force. They were told to see what they can do, but the sheer size of the army that was landing, Hand had no recourse but to turn his force back and act as observers. Cornwallis is deployed with 8,000 men to the town of Flatbush. His mission was to take the town and scout the American position and the size of the force at the Flatbush Pass. Colonel Hand takes the opportunity that's presented to him. He follows Cornwallis's group, and he will harass their left flank. He'll burn any hay or grain that he comes across just so that the British can't use it. The only problem is that this took the scouting force away from the landing zone. Because what happens is it makes it seem like Cornwallis's force is the entirety of the landing force. So Washington has no idea that there's still 12,000 more men landing. So he's beginning to think that there's still 12,000 more redcoats that are running around somewhere. So Washington has to really open up his defenses and protect all possible landing areas because he never knows where those 12,000 are going to pop up, even though they're landing in the third and fourth wave. So once again, the scouting inaccuracies of the early Continental Army cause real problems when it comes to decision-making for Washington. The next morning, on August 23rd, Colonel Hand, with some Continentals and some artillery support, will probe Cornwallis's position at Flatbush. It's here that Colonel Hand's men will get their first look at the Hessians. Now, the Hessians is a group of soldiers that I actually haven't spent any time talking about. I've mentioned in several episodes that Hessians were being brought over, but what the heck is a Hessian? For those who know a little bit about the American Revolution, you know that the Hessians were German soldiers, German mercenaries bought by the British Crown to fight for the British in America. But where does the name Hessian come from? Well, Germany at this time is not a unified country. It's broken up into principalities. It's actually another 50 or so years before Germany is unified into one country. So the principalities are just regions of what we now know as Germany that are run by a prince. And all of the principalities put together are known as the Holy Roman Empire. A lot of the early groups of soldiers were coming out of the principalities of Hesse-Hanau and Hesse-Cassel. So it became this misconception that German soldiers were being called Hessians because they were from several Hesse principalities. Though when we talk about later campaigns, we're going to see a lot of Bohemian soldiers, Bavarian soldiers, and Brunswickers. So the Germans just kind of got this name Hessians and just sort of accepted it. So that's kind of the light version or the cliff note version, the backstory of the Hessians. But I'm actually going to devote an entire episode kind of talking about the relationship between Germany and the British Crown and how it affects sending soldiers to fight for them in America. So Hans' men approach the town of Flatbush. They get into a skirmish. They get their first look at the Hessians. Now, it's not actually confirmed, but it supposedly, it's at least a local legend in Brooklyn, that when they get into this skirmish, they actually kill one of the Hessians and drag his body back as proof that these great and powerful Hessians had come to fight for the British. In the afternoon, the Royal Highlanders are brought up, and they bring up some artillery with them, and so the two sides just exchange artillery shots for the rest of the evening. While this is all going on, the Royal Navy is battling with the batteries on Red Hook. You see, Admiral Howe was trying to make an end run around the defenses to try and get into firing position on Brooklyn Heights. But once again, the wind doesn't cooperate with the British, and they get stuck in a position where they're trading shots with Red Hook. So they abandon their plan to go up the East River and try and fight with the, or lay fire onto the defenses at Brooklyn Heights. For Washington, it's becoming more and more clear that Brooklyn Heights is going to be the target. But Washington still believes that the 8,000 men in front of him are the main attack force, and that there's still 12,000 redcoats running around somewhere. So as fresh militia is arriving in Manhattan, Washington is sending the more seasoned soldiers to Putnam on Long Island. Washington also makes it a point to visit the Long Island defenses daily to kind of get a view or an understanding of what the situation is going to start looking like for him. He wants to understand the defenses. He wants to see the men that are defending them. He wants to see the situation for himself. It's the mark of a good commander. He's not relying on intel from his staff. He's actually looking at it himself. There is one thing that really concerns Washington, and that's the amount of skirmishing that's going on. The Continentals aren't gaining anything by skirmishing with the British. It's also a waste of ammo. It's this first shot mentality that also is not that welcoming to defectors that might want to run to American lines because, well, if the riflemen are just going to shoot you before you get there, what the heck is a defector good for then? General Howe, meanwhile, is continuing his campaign of public opinion. He sent word to the people of Long Island that if they swore an oath to the king, their property and rights would be preserved, and if they wanted to take up arms against the rebellion, to come to the British camp. Howe wants to try and end this war peacefully. He does not want the needless killing of colonials, nor does he want to lose British troops as well. They have enough problems with dealing with some of the European powers, like Spain and France. Why would he want to waste good British troops fighting the colonials if they could just get them to submit peacefully? He knows that this has the opportunity to be a very bloody and costly war, even more so than the French and Indian War. So why would he want to waste good colonial lives and good British lives needlessly? So General Howe is always looking for an opportunity to end the war peacefully and trying to get Long Island to rally. Maybe he can get Manhattan to rally, and maybe public opinion will force Washington to capitulate. It's never going to happen. The Patriots are too well entrenched, and it's just not going to happen. But Howe is trying his hardest to end the war peacefully. Howe continues to order reinforcements from Staten Island, bringing his total of troops on Long Island to 20,000, which leaves about 4,000 on Staten Island. And Howe's counterintelligence was super effective. Washington is believing the entire time that these 20,000 troops are being landed on Long Island that he's only facing a force of 8,000 in front of him. Howe was using his cavalry as a screen. He wanted to block Washington's scouts. He wanted to make sure Washington never knew the true number. Washington had 9,000 men on Long Island, and Howe still outnumbered him 2-1. The American defenses were broken into parts, three parts. General Parsons would command Gowanus Heights. Sterling commanded the American right, which included the Gowanus Road and the Martez Lane Pass. Sullivan commanded the center and the left, including the Bedford and Jamaican passes. Overall command was given to Israel Putnam, who was the second in command of the main Continental Army. Putnam ordered 800 men to the western passes, another 300 men to the gap between the Gowanus Creek and Red Hook to fill the gap there. Old Putt also ordered two battalions of riflemen under Colonel Samuel Miles to a position between the Bedford and Jamaica passes. You see, the Jamaica Pass was well north of the American lines, so it was very unexpected that the British would even try and make an attempt there. So they stationed five officers on horseback almost as an early warning. And if the British did go for the Jamaica Pass, they could warn Miles' men, who can then in turn delay or block the British Army as best as they can until the main force of the Continental Army can be brought into position. Now, Washington was ordered 400 cavalry from Connecticut early on when they were setting up the defenses of Long Island. But he turns them down. He didn't want to have to worry and paying for supplying their mounts. And the cavalry themselves wouldn't fight as an infantry. Well, this decision would unfortunately come back to bite the Continentals in the rear. Literally. Last episode I had mentioned that Clinton had brought up the idea of sailing around the north end of Manhattan and kind of trapping the Continentals between Manhattan and the force on Long Island. Well, this caused a bit of a rift because when Howe turned it down, Clinton kind of took it as a personal affront. So Clinton came up with a new plan. He was going to outflank the Continentals, and he was going to execute it without seeking the advice of General Howe. Now, when I had talked about the triumvirate of personalities, as they would become known, the three British generals that would come over to replace Gage, it's not a surprise that Clinton, Howe, and Burgoyne would never actually see eye to eye on anything because, well, the three men were vying for the same position, to be the top dog in America. So Clinton really doesn't seek the advice of Howe when he makes his bold move, which would be on the night of August 26th. Clinton would march with Cornwallis 4,000 men and 14 cannon toward the Jamaica Pass, the exact position that the Americans thought would be too out of the way for the British to march to. At 2 a.m. on the morning of the 27th, they surprised those same five horsemen that were supposed to be protecting the pass and capturing them without an officer being sent running, a shot being fired. The Americans have no idea that the British are coming through the Jamaica Pass. When Clinton makes it to the Jamaica Pass, he's joined by Howe, who had marched another 6,000 men to reinforce him. Now, I'm sure a lot of you are scratching your head, well, how does Howe know what Clinton's doing? It's not that Clinton did this completely on his own, it's that Clinton just didn't talk to Howe about it. Clinton had no interest in consulting General Howe, the commander-in-chief of the forces in North America, because he didn't believe that he was thinking with a clear head. So he sent word through his secretary or through his adjutant that, hey, this is my plan. So Howe is very well aware of what Clinton's plan is and what he's doing, but he's not bringing it to his face. So Clinton reinforces him. It's now time that they're going to spring the trap, and the largest battle of the American Revolution is about to begin. But it's going to begin over a watermelon. See, part of Clinton's plan called for General James Grant on the British left wing to move against Gowanus Heights. This was a complete distraction. Grant led 5,000 men, including 2,000 Royal Marines and two companies of Long Island Tories, to the Martens Lane Pass, where they were going to distract the American right wing, thus giving Clinton the opportunity to exploit an opening in the American rear. So Grant marched his men up the Gowanus Road towards the pass. His scouts had arrived at the intersection, and located on the spot is the Red Lion Inn. Behind the inn is a watermelon patch. Watermelons are an American delicacy. They're very sought after. So it's not a surprise that it's a very enticing thing to see a vacant watermelon patch, and these scouts just have to procure some of their own. No sooner do they start picking the delicious fruit that they come under fire by Colonel Hand's riflemen. So the scouts fall back, and Grant sits on the position. At about midnight, Hand's men are relieved after 4 days in this position by local militia. This was the opening that Grant needed. He sends 300 men towards the inn to scatter the militia. The untested, poorly trained militia retreats. Luckily, the commander, before he is captured, is able to send word to Putnam of the attack. Putnam, jumping out of his bed, lights the signal fires to get all encampments along the American lines ready for battle. He sends word to Washington on Manhattan that the attack has begun and that he should get over to Long Island. By 3 a.m., Putnam will ride to the forts to rouse Sterling. Sterling will march 2,000 men to oppose Grant. It appeared that Grant was marching towards the Continental's inner line. Once again, this is just a feint, so he's making it look like he's pressing the attack, but really, he's just trying to draw the troops out so that this leaves an opening for Clinton. General Parsons will join Sterling's force as they march against Grant. So a chance meeting at a watermelon patch would turn into a major battle. This was the first time that the Continentals would meet the British in line and formation. All the battles that we were talking about beforehand, Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill, these battles were fought with the Americans from protected positions, behind stone walls, impromptu fortifications, trees, anything that could stop a musket ball. This is the first time that the British are going to stand in a line in formation in the European way and oppose probably one of the best standing armies in the world at the time. Seeing the Americans line up, it's not a surprise that the overzealous Grant believes that he is going to just roll over the Americans. See, the British officers had little respect for the Americans, Grant especially. You see, it was when Lord Sterling was giving his position at the House of Parliament, Grant was one of his biggest denouncers, saying that he was a patriot. He was an American in British clothing. He said all kinds of vicious things to Sterling. So the overzealous Grant is just going to want to charge full steam and prove to the world that Sterling is a poser. You see, his overconfidence is what's going to proved to be his biggest roadblock. Sterling's troops were from Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Maryland, all considered to be some of the best troops, most well-trained, and most well-equipped of Washington's army. So as Grant closed with the Americans give them a fight. They're holding their own against the British regulars. Not only that, they have two cannons that are also causing some problems for Grant. So Grant pulls his men back, and he switches to artillery. He believes that, well, once I start firing the big guns, that will dislodge the Americans. Still nothing. The Continentals were too well trained. One Continental soldier will write, "The enemy advanced towards us," upon which Lord Sterling drew up and in a line and offered them a battle in the true English taste. The British advanced within 200 yards of us and began heavy fire from their cannons and mortars. For both balls and shells flew very fast and now and then taking off ahead. Our men stood amazingly well. Grant had no choice but to send a detachment to link up with von Heister's Hessians. He was going to overwhelm Sterling's position no matter what. Except Sterling was too quick. He caught the attempt, and he saw that they were going to try and encircle him. So he sends word to General Parsons and to Colonel Attlee to take up the high ground on his left flank to meet the new threat. Parsons and Attlee, who also had troops from Pennsylvania and Delaware, take three attempts by the Hessians and turn them back all three times. At one point, Parsons' men killed a Colonel Grant. His name was written in his hat. That's how they knew his name. And they thought they actually killed the general. This sent excitement through the lines like you wouldn't believe. Well, I don't think they found out until after the battle that it wasn't the general, but still, when you have that kind of adrenaline rush, oh, we killed the British general. Now we got some steam. Probably put some real fire in the saddles of the Americans. Sterling was proud of his men for their bravery and their discipline. The only problem was that Sterling believed this was the main British attack, like Putnam, like Washington. Unfortunately, to the east, the battle would take a very different turn. And that's where we're going to stop this week. I could keep going, but this episode would turn into an hour-long episode about the Battle of Brooklyn. And as I've said multiple times to you guys, that's just not my style. I don't want to do hour and a half long episodes. I want to make them quick, concise, bring you guys the facts. I don't want to overwhelm you with too much details and everything. So I thought the best way to do the Battle of Brooklyn Heights was in a two-parter. So that's where we're going to end this week. As for a book recommendation, I haven't done those in a couple episodes. I have a new one for us. The Battle for New York by Brett Schechner. This is pretty much the gold standard for the Battle of Brooklyn, White Plains, Harlem Heights. All of it is in this book. It covers the entire campaign. It's probably the best resource that I have, and the one I've used the most to bring together all the information that I have. I've kind of been using this book as kind of my guide to how I'm going to lay out each episode, because Schechter just really does a good job of explaining everything in really good detail, and each chapter is a new step in the process of the campaign. The invasion, the battles, everything is just step by step, so every chapter you know what you're getting into. So it's definitely a good book to get, and one, when it comes to at least the Battle of Brooklyn Heights, one that I highly recommend. So that's going to do it for this week. I can't wait to get to next week where we conclude the battle, talk about what happens to Washington's army after the battle, and everything like that. So till then, everyone have a good weekend, because I'm going to be hopefully doing the episode on Monday. Have a good couple of days. Have a good and safe St. Paddy's Day. And always remember, keep the powder dry.